Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
Rero! Scooby-Doo!
How are you?
What up? Have we had a three-time guest, four-time guest?
I think Brad is the most favorite guest in that respect.
And it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because he's a legend.
He truly is.
By the way, which Brad's on today?
Boom, boom.
Yeah. Well, because we don't have digital props. You're now just doing a fake drum.
Well, I mean, I could do a digital, you know.
Maybe like the worst produced popular podcast of all time.
How about that one?
Yeah. Your head's already in Norway.
What? Where? Huh? What?
Yeah. So you're going.
I'm going for a trip.
You're not taking the fam.
No.
This is why the Europeans just have this whole swagger that no American woman's going to let their husband go to Norway during COVID without them.
Well, my wife is American.
Special lady.
Yep.
So what do you plan on doing?
I plan on being in quarantine at my cabin up in the mountains for about a week to 10 days, depending on how long they want to.
But I'm going to be skiing
and, you know, smelling the pine trees and eating the snow. And,
all right. Are you going to see some friends?
In time, yeah.
Oh, really? You're really just doing quarantine?
Not right off the bat. I mean,
with all your money in Norway, no vaccines?
They are behind.
Huh.
They're dorks.
Really?
Yeah. Even the Swedes are doing better than those more.
By the way, that guy yesterday was like, you guys are the Arabs of Scandinavia. Which is pretty good.
Because we got oil?
Yes, you do. There's the Swedes. What were they? The Swedes are just farting around.
I don't know.
And it was pretty funny.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Brad Feld is on the show. What can I say about Brad? He's tall, handsome. He was my first investor at Wall Street.
That is right.
And then he is foundry as the investor in StockTwit.
All right.
And he knows where Norway is on a map. He's no dummy. Today, he was in Colorado doing his thing, foundry group. I don't know, they're on fund 60, 70 at this point. He started investing when he was 11. And so we've done all the past. I want to talk about the future. He and a group of pals and businessmen did a SPAC. And that surprised me when I saw it. So I'm excited to just ask high level what went on there.
Cool.
And as we get close to the end of COVID here, what's the future look like? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to keep it really simple today. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
You're sure? Because we can't go back and change it again for the 12th
100%.
Time. All right, let's ring them up.
All right.
Howdy.
How's it going?
It's good.
And you are in Aspen?
Amy and I are in Aspen, where it snowed about 6 inches last night, so it looks beautiful outside.
And what is the mood? Atmosphere in Aspen. Has it been a nice winter there, you think, or everybody quarantined and traffic way down?
I have no idea, because the only time I leave my house is to go running. And when I go running, I go for long runs, usually an hour to 4 hours. And I would like to run in the mountains. So in the wintertime, there's not a lot of people where I go running.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really know.
Okay.
But the mood in the house that Amy and I are in is really good because the two of us love being together 24 hours a day.
Yeah. I'm always worried that if that happened to me and Ellen, there'd just be a coroner very quickly. Oh, what happened?
You know, we spent most of our relationship, like the first, 80% of our relationship, never together because I was traveling.
That's true.
So there has been something. I mean, there's been many, many really challenging things about the last year, but one of the real joys of the last year has been that the two of us get to spend all our time together.
Yeah, I got my daughter reading your blog, sending emails behind my back. Is it okay that she's sending you emails?
She's a much better writer than you are. So.
There are less typos and apologies in her emails, I've noticed. She doesn't say she's as sorry as often as I have to. Sorry. So Amy's the best. I don't know. I have to get her now for podcast to catch up to you. What you guys have been reading, like catching up on reading or no? Is it just work? I find myself, Brad, just working and I'm getting a lot done and it feels like you're just working. So how do you divide up the day if you're not leaving the house?
Yeah, we read a lot. Both of us are huge readers and love like laying on the couch, you know, each with a book in hand. Interestingly, it's episodic though, because there's definitely days where, you know, 7 o'clock, your brain does not want to read. It's got nothing in it. So, you know, like many, I think we've watched a lot of TV, a lot of Netflix, a lot of Amazon Prime. But we've run out of interesting stuff. And every time we try something new, it's pretty shitty. So we've struggled recently to find anything interesting. We watched the other night, just as an example, Netflix sends the list of the movies that are going off it in the next 30 days. And one of them was a Brad Pitt movie we hadn't seen called Killing Them Softly. And we're like, we haven't seen that. We kind of like Brad Pitt. And it was dark. And it probably needs to go off Netflix and be gone. We do a lot of reading on the weekends. And it's a broad range, because one of the things that we've both historically done is not watch much or not pay much attention to the news. She pays more attention to it than I do. And around the election cycle in the US, it was impossible not to pay attention to it because it was so insane. But that's all turned off. The volume of that's gone back down. So that's opened up a lot of space.
It really has, it really took a lot of headspace, raised the temperature for, I feel, no reason.
It's so nice. I would say it's so nice to be back to the normal bullshit of everyday politics.
and no one does more to help out than you. So it's like, what's the tone been? Like even my daughter who read your blog and chimed in on Boundless, like it feels like nothing good could even reach the surface for a while.
Yeah, everybody has their view of how the world works. And one of the things that's always instructive to me is to go back in time or go forward in time, right? Go back in time and read some history from a long time ago or read some science fiction. And what you realize is that, we're humans and humans just do what humans do. And there's the endless challenges and you get to decide where you want to engage and what you want to do and the finite period of time that we've got on this planet. And one of the lessons from the last 12 months, at least for me in the endless conversations that Amy and I have, one of the things we do, you asked about our days, we start each day off with what we now call morning coffee. So we spend about 30 minutes together first thing in the morning and we have coffee together and we just talk. And we don't even talk about anything in particular. It's not, the day to come or what happened, it's wherever it goes. And sometimes the conversations get pretty deep and sometimes they're really just logistics of what's upcoming. But one of the things that's been reinforced in that from us is the importance of choosing when you have the ability, choosing how you want to spend your time. And I think it is a really hard thing to do, especially against the backdrop of so many things that are struggles.
Yeah. Ellen and I have the exact, I hope she don't listen to this because then she'll analyze how bad our relationship is. But we wake up, have coffee, and we trade GameStop and see who can make the most money by 10 a.m. Is that normal or not normal? I mean, you know us.
I think it's pretty normal for you guys at least. I think she's probably not trading. She's just laughing at you and cheering.
She literally hasn't made a trade and she's doing better than me. So we've been at it 2 weeks. I'm down about $6,000 and she's beating me, but by definitely not doing anything and just drinking her coffee. So there is a lesson in that. I would like to just...
Howard, I have this website. You should follow this website called StockTwits because they've got a pretty good...
Overrated. Yeah.
Pretty good thing about...
Once they got rid of the CEO, nothing but headaches for the firm. So I find myself, Brad, because we don't talk that often, and now we're on Signal together talking about, dirty things. But now that, before Signal, and before we picked up our conversation, like grown men. Oh, first, how's your prostate? Because every time I pee, I go, well, I wonder how Brad's
well.
Flow
the
is.
The surgery I had was very successful.
No, you didn't have surgery, but you're fine, right? Because I worry about that. At 55, I just don't know what's going to... There's a moment of anxiety as I run to the bathroom. So I find it hard, and I have to think you do too, is I'm working too hard. How do you separate it? Because it's endless work with Zoom.
I put parameters around it, and I'm conscious of trying to adhere to those parameters. So the very specific ones that I've adopted are, I start the day with coffee with Amy. We have lunch to every day scheduled for 30 minutes. And I would say 4 out of 5 days a week, we have lunch together. So we have a 30-minute break from whatever we're doing. I try very hard during the week not to schedule anything after 6 p.m. So sometimes I have work to do in the evening. Sometimes I don't, but I try not to have anything scheduled after that. I do put regular blocks on my calendar that are not schedulable time, usually mornings, and that varies depending on what's going on. But I try to adhere to a couple of hours, 2-3 hours, at least 2 or 3 days a week of just unschedulable time. I don't schedule anything on Fridays. I do plenty of meetings and things, but nothing scheduled. And then I do not, from sundown Friday night till Sunday morning, I'm offline. So no email, no meetings, no anything. I call it digital Sabbath. It's not religious, but obviously it takes its tone from the Sabbath. And I find that the most important reset each week for me. If I don't do that each week, I get worn out pretty quickly. And then Sundays, I also don't schedule anything. I am online and interact, but I won't schedule any meetings. So if I look at sort of my tempo, I have this very intense period of time between Monday and end of day Thursday, but time-bounded in terms of schedule so that I have plenty of non-scheduled time. And then I have 3 days each week that's unscheduled. And that gives me enough space. And, you know, within that, I obviously run a lot and exercise and read, and Amy and I spend time together. But interestingly, and I think this is a thing that many people, for many people, it has been blurred because of COVID. I personally used to spend a lot of time getting from point A to point B. And that could be whether I was just in town in Boulder going from one meeting to another, or, you know, on a plane going from one city to another. And all that time is eliminated from the schedule. I don't know how to do that right now. And interestingly, there was a lot of tension release in that movement, even if I was on the phone or even if I was trying to do things in between moving from point A to point B. You were shifting context in a way that allowed you to loosen up a little. And I think the time boxing of the interaction, which could go, I mean, it could go from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day, and it could go all weekend long, or it could be at all these other random times. Like, compressing it allows me to then get some of that intellectual and physical release that you need that was otherwise happening in the movement from point A to point B.
As a professional venture capitalist, and I'm one in training still, I could see myself never attending. I'm not a big board person anyways. I'm only on 3 or 4, and they don't listen, so they won't. I'm not worried. If I say I'm never going to a board meeting, as someone who am I crazy? If I say Zoom will work for me for the rest of my life, is that something that's believable or not?
Well, if you get categorized as crazy, then you can just join my crazy club. If somebody said that to you if you said it to somebody in January 2020, they would have said you're nuts.
Right.
That won't work. However, now, obviously, that's totally accepted. That's how we're all living our lives. I don't think it's crazy at all. I have no personal intention of traveling post-COVID for all the things that I used to travel for. I've been effectively a remote worker for many, many years because I've always invested all across the U.S. So even if I was, you know, traveling from point A to point B, I was doing a bunch of other things remotely. And, you know, many times I'd be in City A and have two board meetings where one board meeting was in the city I was in and the other board meeting was halfway across the country or across the country. So I've been having to function that way for a long time, and I'm very comfortable with it. And what we've just demonstrated to, you know, the universe of entrepreneurship is, and by the way, a lot of people don't like it. So separate like from able to. We are certainly able to do all the things we do around venture capital, entrepreneurship, investing, and scaling companies for companies that are knowledge-based businesses completely in a fully distributed fashion. By the way, not new information, right? There have been companies like Automatic and others who are very well known for behaving that way, you know, from inception. Mm-hmm. But we just had that in its entirety. And it's not just in the private markets, but also in the public markets. I mean, the amount of transactional activity that's being done completely remotely.
Mind-boggling.
Is extraordinary. And, you know, having been involved in taking, you know, I was involved as a principal in taking a couple of companies public where I was on the roadshow. And, you know, like a roadshow for an IPO, I think the first one I was involved in was 1999. And it was 3 weeks on private planes flying around the U.S. to meetings where you'd meet with somebody for 30 minutes and maybe they'd look at you after they shook your hand and you'd give your spiel. And then you'd go to your black car and get whisked away to the next meeting and do that for 3 or 4 times in each city. And maybe you'd go to Europe for a couple of days at the beginning of it just to shake the dust off the presentation. And compared to a contemporary roadshow, that in some cases is being done in 1 day.
Yeah, we did ours on Zoom. I can't wait to hear your story, but you can't put that back in the box. The margins are just too good and the experience is too good.
You know, when you realize that actually people are not making the decision based on the 30 minutes that they spend with you in person, why is that 30 minutes physically in person the requirement of that motion, which was institutionalized? And it's like so many other things. I mean, you think about the digitization of so many of our activities leading up to the pre-COVID time period. You know, we're investors in and advocates of and participants in this massive digitization of so many things in business. But yet the overhang of this illusion of the importance of the physical proximity, there's absolutely value to physical interaction and physical proximity around certain characteristics of it. But there's, I don't know, 80, 90% of it where that's actually just incumbency behavior rather than something that's fundamentally needed. So I believe we're on the other side of it. I think people will decide whether they want to be with other people or not, and that's up to them. I think the best companies are going to be able to function with people wherever those people are, whether they're physically proximate to each other or completely distributed. The best companies are going to be able to adjust for what people want and use that as a tool for their businesses rather than something that's either a cost layer that they may or may not want or an inhibition because they want to create a certain type of culture that requires a certain type of behavior.
Yeah. So while I have you, I want to go back and just compare some notes about how you're thinking about the world and the Big Bang and what we've seen. So I'm new to technology and I'm trying to put together my thoughts about the future because I now have capital to invest both for LPs and myself, and I don't like to trade. I love watching the markets, but I want to kind of position myself in a less stressful world. So I'm trying to look at the world in stages. And we had the, I'll go back a little bit. We had the railroad bubble, which was in essence a great bubble because it tied the country together to move to ship goods, the original internet. And then we had a nothing, wars, blah, 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 poverty. Oil crises, yada, yada, yada. Then we had the internet bubble, another phenomenal bubble. But really, the only thing that we got out of that bubble, which was great, was bandwidth. Then we had the financial crisis. No, sorry. Then we had, I think, the most important moment, because everybody thought BlackBerry would never die, I would say the smartphone. So kind of the internet was the internet, but it was really all about the bandwidth. And, you know, you have your stories. Everybody has their stories, you know, the bubble. But really, the end of the bubble was bandwidth, which was the most important part. The second most important part was, I say, YouTube and smartphone, followed by the financial crisis, followed obviously now by the idea of fintech, and we could say it's trading, crypto, payments, etc. And then now, finally, another big moment, and this is all now in hindsight. I feel like we didn't really have anything in, you know, you can count social, I don't even count social networks. I would say Zoom and COVID. And I'm trying to think about, you know, what I'm missing from like the biggest of big bangs. Because you were there right at the beginning of the internet. Does any of that make sense to you? And what am I missing about the internet other than bandwidth that was important from the first bubble?
Well, I have a somewhat different view on the product side than that, because I don't think it was only bandwidth. And one of the interesting reflections 20 years later is that many of the ideas that were emergent in the late 90s are ideas that are implemented in commonplace today, but the software, the devices, the infrastructure, which I presume you can include bandwidth in, didn't exist to affect a true behavior change. So an example that I would give you would be in 1997, I was an investor in a company called iPro. And iPro had this premise, and their entirety of their premise was based on tracking advertising from offline to online, from analog to digital. And the idea that there would be this continual shift to digital advertising, and that would create an enormous market, and that enormous market needed to have analytics that were embedded within the web, and the metaphor proxy for that company would be, for example, Nielsen or something like that, if I can get my mind to remember back that long. And that was not the only company like that. There were a whole bunch of companies that were created around that. The fundamental premise was the acceleration of analog to digital advertising and media, and then people's attention. And there's a great cliche graph that showed how fast it took, you know, to go from, you know, zero to a million telephones, zero to a million TVs, zero to a million, you know, internet dial-up connections. When you time travel back, like, all that stuff is right, and that's woven deeply into the infrastructure that we now use on a daily basis. And if you contemplate how all of that stuff works, many of the assertions or premises were correct, but there just wasn't enough of the various pieces in that stack that were needed. Another example, which, you know, we can use video conferencing because you mentioned it, like the idea of Zoom is not a new idea, right? I mean, going back in time to the 90s, video conferencing over the internet was one of the things that was popular as a completely game-changing thing. If you go back to the 60s, you can watch Jetsons cartoons that had the equivalent of video conferencing in them. And we've been talking about for as long as I can remember, as even as a kid, about video telephones and that sort of stuff. There were many things that had to come into place to cause that to sort of snap into, you know, the contemporary dominant motion. And for video conferencing, frankly, in a work context, it was COVID. It was not the technology. The technology had existed for many years. The bandwidth was there. The software was there. Maybe it wasn't as easy or convenient or whatever. But what happened is, in a matter of about 2 weeks, the entirety of the global in-office workforce that wasn't part of manufacturing or delivery, production or delivery of physical goods, had to figure out how to work from their houses. And I remember in the end of March, the premonitions that the infrastructure couldn't support it, the software couldn't support it, the companies would fall over, nobody be able to get through. You had to take your Netflix down to lower bandwidth, and you could only use it for a little bit of time because it was going to get in the way of your kids going to school and all this sort of stuff. And lo and behold, you know, there was a lot of effort put in by a lot of people, but all that infrastructure exists, all that software exists. You could just go down every single one of the things that we use today and go back 20 years, and the premonition of many of those things, not all of them, but many of those things were there. So looking backwards, sort of interesting, because it gives you a little bit of a roadmap to remember that it's a conversation that's been going on for a long time. Somebody says, oh, wait a second, you know, crypto is a totally new thing and nobody's ever talked about digital currency before. Like, bullshit. That was a huge vector pre-internet bubble, post-internet.
But like COVID, the financial crisis brought it. I was trying to say the moments that it became important. No doubt that this stuff has been thematically going on for...
No, but it's not just that there was a moment that kicked into gear, but there was this continual evolution of the technology that then intercepted with the moment that created the transformation. Now, this is you know, where this goes that I think is interesting is when you look forward.
That's where I was getting at. So now, so just since I have you, this is where I was trying to get you to. So now that we have this potential moment ahead, COVID almost behind us or not, but the opening ahead of us, where does Brad Feld and Foundry with some conviction see things?
Well, it's a great question on one level, and it's an impossible question on the other. And I prefer to address it as an impossible question, which is, if you look at things in a time period of 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, there's so much uncertainty in the next 12 months that really all you can do with the next 20 years is have a frame of reference on where things could go or a hypothesis about where things could go. And from my perspective, I've always approached that as abstract. So for example, when you say, where do you, Brad, think things go in the next 20 years? I have no idea if our societal structure is sustained for the next 20 years in the way that it works. And, you know, somebody will quickly say, oh, well, that, how could you say that? Do you mean you're worried about the future of democracy? No, I'm actually not really even thinking about it from that dimension. I don't think as humans, we have any idea what things will look like in 2040. And I think if we somehow were put in suspended automation and then reappeared in 2040, I think we'd look around and say, I don't understand. Now, you could say, well, there's going to be flying taxis and there's going to be flying this and there's going to be infinite bandwidth and energy is going to be, virtually free. And but that's not actually the interesting thing to talk about. How does that then change the way that as humans we interact with each other, both locally and globally? And when I sort of extrapolate out from that, my view is the intersection between humans and machines is going to radically increase. The ability for everything to be distributed, whatever you want to classify as everything, both digital and physical, will be dramatically increased. The artificial boundaries that we have created, whether they are geographic boundaries in cities, states, countries, counties, nations, whatever, or there are physical boundaries a la organizations or buildings, functional boundaries like organizations or physical boundaries like buildings, all of the historical way that we've approached them 20 years from now will be obliterated. And there might be artifacts and remnants of the way we approach them in 2019. But if you think of 2021 versus 2019, just even in the context of physical infrastructure, the way we're using our physical infrastructure today is extremely different because of 120 nanometer thing. Lots of people will want to go back to using our physical infrastructure the way we used to, but there are lots of people who won't. There are plenty of people who, the way our physical infrastructure has worked, puts them at a structural disadvantage. The whole discussion around equity, especially economic equity for both gender and race has been a very powerful one. And I think we're just beginning to even scratch the surface of a reconfiguration of that on a going forward basis. And so, you know, in the next year, okay, maybe there's a conversation to be had, but the next 20 years, no fucking clue.
Awesome. And so what excites you? What, I mean, because you take email like me, cold email, your mind's open. What is exciting to Brad? Because I know last time I checked for the first 3 years, crypto wasn't interesting to you, but I got to think decentralization is the issue. And the other thing about this bubble that rages here right now, which I love, is we have a chance to free ourselves, whether we like it or not, or whether we want it or not, from Facebook, Google, with decentralization. If there wasn't this bubble, we wouldn't have this other side, all this money on the other side right now trying to disrupt them. Have you changed your opinion on any of that?
I like the word decentralization much more than crypto, because it applies to many, many more things other than just money. And I think that the notion of decentralization has been pretty fundamental in a lot of the stuff I've been involved in as an investor. And, you know, I could even use physical examples of that with hardware companies, you know, that make industrial products that now fit on a desktop so you can have decentralized manufacturing. So you don't have to have a physical manufacturing facility to make small things, small numbers of things. If you want to do high volume production, you probably still will do that in a centralized facility. But the idea of moving the means of production closer to whoever is the consumer of the thing is, you know, a physical instantiation of decentralization. Obviously, the whole future of work and motion of work plays into that, where people live. I mean, I've lived in Colorado for 25 years and I've invested all across the US. My view, going back to coming out of the financial crisis, was very, very strong that we were shifting from a hierarchical view to a network view of society, and that hierarchies would still exist, but networks were going to be the dominant form of engagement. And as part of that, I had a very, you know, strong thesis, deeply held view that entrepreneurship and innovation should be democratized globally, or decentralized, if you want to use that word. And the idea that you had to go to Silicon Valley to build a business was ludicrous. And even in 2012, when I came out with the book titled Startup Communities, where the fundamental thesis was any city with at least 100,000 people should be able to build a vibrant startup community, there was still the cliche that if you were really serious about creating a company, you needed to go to the Bay Area. And I think in 2021, that cliche is gone. The Bay Area is still an amazing place to build companies and to create new businesses. But there are enormous number of examples of incredible companies throughout the world, and many, many, many entrepreneurial companies, and many examples of startup communities that are extremely vibrant and growing very, very quickly, where innovation is at the core of those geographies. And then again, with COVID, sort of understanding better how to think about that in a network model versus a physical geographic model. So it doesn't have to be place-based. It can be much more about the networks of people and how they interact with each other. So that phenomena, which we've been forced into because of COVID to live in a certain way with it, coming out of COVID, there's multiple different frames of reference. There's definitely the frame of reference that coming out of it, everybody's going to snap right back to where they were in 2020 in January. I simply don't believe that. I think we have a structural change, and the word decentralization is at the core of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 100% with you, because can't wait to travel to certain places with certain people, but you're just not going to get me to work in that way again. And I'm almost embarrassed that how much I chased and thought it was important to do certain things, and how much extra risk we all took living that pre-COVID life, last minute trips, you know, overnight flights, to shake hands, to get your face in front of you. How would it be different, do you think, for like Rachel and Matt or any kid? Because I think I feel bad for them, because I don't know if you, as the 25-year-old starting out in business, can catch up without the face-to-face. So what would you think about that?
Historical reference here might be useful. I mean, we're the same age. And so I firmly embrace the notion that I'm an early member of Generation X. I was born in end of 1965, so I'm at the front end of it. I'm definitely not part of the boomer generation. And, you know, for those of you that don't know anything about Generation X and you want a taste of it, I encourage you to read Douglas Copeland's eponymous book called Generation X. I think it was written in 1991. And it doesn't describe Generation X. It just tells a story, and you get a total feel for what was going on in that time period between, you know, amongst people who were in that age range, right, in their mid-20s. And it was a particularly challenging time to be in your mid-20s because of the macro dynamics that were going on in the United States. I can't speak about the world because I don't know that I had enough perspective outside the U.S. And during that period of time, you know, the reason that, you know, we're labeled slackers, you know, as a generation, is because that was where that came from. Like this whole notion of, you know, fuck it, the world's not going to get better. Can't fix anything. Not nihilistic, but maybe fatalistic. You know, I have a job because I have to have a job because I need to have money to pay for my food, but not because I have any aspiration for anything. sort of at the essence of it. And I'm describing this as a cultural norm, not as a broad characterization. And if you look at, you know, people that are in their mid-40s to mid-50s today, and sort of trace back, there's obviously been many, 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 many people that went through that and created new things and new ways of being for themselves and for the people around them and for their businesses. And I think that phenomenon will happen with Rachel and her generation. And, you know, my parents don't understand my generation, and I won't, and you won't understand your kids' generation. And part of the changes that happen across those boundaries are both social changes as well as broad societal changes that are a result sometimes of product innovation, technology, et cetera, and sometimes aren't. And for anybody who's, anybody who any of this rings true to, you know, just watch some period pieces. Go watch a couple episodes of Mad Men and try to put yourself back in that trajectory. Go watch, you know, think about what Silicon Valley was really like in the 1960s and the 1970s and what, you know, what Haight-Ashbury represented in that period of time. Or go watch Milk or something from, you know, a different segment of the time period.
I say go watch Downton Abbey. It's a technology show, really, if you think about it.
There you go, right? Like all of these things, like we're just humans. Like shit's going to keep changing and it's going to keep happening and people are going to figure it out. And there are, I'll come back to something I said earlier, there are massive inequities in our society. And when you're in a position of having resources, you can choose what you want to do with those resources in your time. And if you choose to try to be involved in addressing and supporting improvement of society from some frame of reference, I'm not going to be moralistic about it, but you can choose to allocate time, energy, resources to that, or you cannot and allocate your time, energy to other things. And those are always going to be part of the human experience as a species, and where we go is going to be unpredictable as a result. I'm very optimistic for Rachel because she has you as an example of what not to do, and she has Ellen as an example of what to do.
Yeah, smarty pants. The so one of the most exciting things that I've done. First of all, I appreciate that because I'm super, super, and maybe because I'm 55 and have some freedom. And do you find yourself, Brad? Anytime I'm upset, I'm like, hey man, I'm 55. I don't have to do that. Do you use that line, or is it just me?
I don't use that line, but I have something. Actually, it's probably not said the same way. Not said the same way, but something I'm trying to do a better job on now that I'm 55 versus when I was 35, mm-hmm. which is much of my life and much of my choices, while they benefited me, have not necessarily been for me. Hmm. They are choices and things that I've done for others rather than choosing to do it for me. And that's my own stuff. Yeah. That's not, yeah. You know, my therapist gets lots of time with me on that topic.
Right.
And as I'm getting older, and I am, you know, you get older almost, for me at least, the reality of mortality, and I didn't realize that was going to rhyme, but I like that. The reality of mortality starts to become clearer, one's mortality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has to do with aging people around you. I had a extraordinarily close friend, really a second father, who was the guy who bought my first company, a guy named Len Fassler, who was my greatest mentor. I learned the most from Len about kind of everything with regard to business during not just the time when he bought my first company, but then, you know, the 2 decades after that, where we worked together on a number of companies, some successful, some not. And it wasn't just about business, but it was about how to engage with people and how to really work with people. He passed away in January. He was, you know, he was ill for a while. And, you know, those kinds of things are pretty foundational. So for me, it is in this crisis, and it comes back to the question you asked earlier, Howard, about how I spend my time and where are the boundaries, right? Putting more of that in place for me mm-hmm. to make sure that there's enough that I'm doing enough things that are feeding me, versus all the things I'm doing are depleting me or feeding others. And, you know, really simple example, again, that ties back to the whole notion of, am I crazy? Am I Howard crazy that I would never physically go to a board meeting again? I don't know how many millions of miles I traveled, going from thing to thing, board meeting to board meeting, meeting to meeting, city to city. That wasn't for me. I mean, there was certainly for my professional career, there was an element of that. But most of that motion was because I felt obligated to do that based on the contextual environment I was operating in. And that was in, you know, I'd say that was an illusion of my own construction. Like, what? I have control over that. And I'm fortunate that I have the resources to not just have control over it, but to also be able to influence my environment so that I can be effective, you know, within that motion. So I guess I just encourage, I mean, and I encourage is the wrong word. That's how I think about it. And I, you know, people want to think about it that way. Great. If people don't like the way to think about it that way, that's fine too. That's maybe what I encourage is that people spend time thinking about what's important to them. And I think in our contemporary society, we do not spend enough, people do not spend enough time on that.
Yeah, I'm calling it be better selfish, meaning I was doing all these selfish things, but they were so sloppy. And time is all I got. So I just want to be, I don't want to be mean about it, but I want to be selfish, but aware, like just a better selfish. And I think, like I said, these are the big bang moments for me. And Zoom being one of them, even though, like you said, it's been around for 100 years, the whole idea that we would do this. But now I have the tool that allows me to be better selfish, and it's a win-win-win, I think. So I just have to explain it better and kind of stay true to this. It's like the new serenity now. So one of the things that got me...
just to end on that spectrum, yeah. Howard, like there's a bunch of people who are going to be comfortable with those things, and then there's people that aren't. And I think one of the challenges for many is the fear that one will miss an opportunity if they don't adapt to what other people want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other end of the spectrum, which is the reality that when, you know, my dad said for many years, when you're dead, they put you in the ground. Although we joke about whether they put you in the ground or they put you in an urn and ashes. Maybe, you know, if you're successful and well-known, they print your picture in a newspaper. And, you know, 2 weeks later, everybody's on with their lives. He would say that to me when I was a little kid, sort of as a focus of pay attention to the moment, pay attention to the now. And I just go back to like, you know, the fear of missing the opportunity, actually the cliche FOMO or fear of missing out, needs to just turn it upside down, right? And make it the joy of missing out, right? It's actually fine with me to miss lots of opportunities because the other person and I didn't necessarily want to engage with each other. That's fine. If they don't want to, awesome. Go do your own thing. I'll do my thing. Because there's so many things to do. And why not do them from a frame of reference of what you really want to be doing versus what you feel obligated to do or that you're chasing after?
So in the end, to end it with one thing then on that subject, there were no odds makers anywhere in the world that had Feld Lindzen SPAC 2021. First of all, from my angle, it's cool. Like when I saw that you were doing it, because I was down that path and this legitimizes Lindzenity that I'm doing it. But more importantly, it's the most fascinating.
Or maybe it illegitimizes me.
Yes, but I can't. You should say that. I will not say that. That would not be smart by me. But yes, you should joke and say that. It took a year to get my head around it. And now I think it's, you know, it's not decentralized, but it's the coolest thing that I've worked on. And again, I'm old and not old, like, you know, put me to retire, but like set in my ways. And so it's kind of the funnest, newest thing, you know, especially with the band that we put together that I've done since I started Social Leverage with Tom and Gary. And, you know, I love working with my partners. But once you've seen the end zone, you know, it's like once the Wizard of Oz, once you meet the wizard, you got to change things up. So how did you get suited up to do this? Who the hell had a photo of you doing something that you ended up working on a SPAC?
I've been thinking about it on and off for a while, very immaturely and with a premise that wasn't necessarily valid. Around a particular industry that I thought needed to be consolidated. And so it wasn't a new thought to me, but I didn't really totally understand it. Then in relatively short order, as I started going deeper on it, I realized that there are, you know, something that I've struggled with as an investor for many years, not in a negative way, just sort of trying to process in terms of strategy, is there's multiple layers of where people engage in the capital stack. And one of the things that had been happening in technology and in the universe I play in, which is very different from when I started, was the shift of the boundary between public markets and private markets. And, you know, there have been that boundary has moved over time up and down.
That's what I've been focused on for 20 years. Yeah.
Right. But that boundary moved so far up, where up is defined as the entry point for being a public company, your market cap being so high because of the desire of a series of forces, a bunch of cliches, some factual assertions, but really fundamentally a number of investors who were very focused on capturing that value privately. And then by the time that value increased to a certain level, then those companies would be available to the public market. And that made no sense to me as an investor.
Correct. They were hoarding and, you know, we let them get away with it.
So that was really the aha moment for me. And once I understood that, I started thinking about, you know, companies in my experience that had gone public that we'd had successful IPOs with in market caps that were, you know, $500 million to a couple of $1 billion. And then what happened to them over time when they were successful were their value accreted, but in the public market instead of in the private markets, and how those companies as public companies were actually stronger companies than their private company equivalents because the public markets made them get their shit together on a bunch of dimensions.
Correct.
And how in a lot of ways, because there wasn't capital piled on top of capital piled on top of capital, it created a lot more flexibility for everyone in the capital stack, everybody that were owners of the company, to make their choices about what they wanted to do with their ownership position, whether they wanted to hold it forever or whether they wanted to sell pieces of it at different points in time, which granted, there are now efforts in the private markets to make more liquidity in the private markets. So the private markets look like private versions of the public market. But fundamentally, I sort of looked at this and said, yeah, this is a transposition of that activity. So for me, the focal point was finding a partner, you know, beyond my partners at Foundry, who I felt was purpose-built to do this type of thing as a repeatable business. And that person in my world was Jim Lejeal, who was multi-time CFO of several companies, has also been a several public companies, has also been CEO, has also been somebody who has sold public companies to other public companies. So sort of very comfortable operator, very disciplined and very much a student of all of the elements of what you have to do in a serious way. And, you know, that against the backdrop of our extremely large network, both direct and indirect companies and through our investments in other funds and our network that we have, made it a very, very interesting thing to explore and to go do. And it's been very powerful. It's been fascinating. And it's been amazing to me to watch how quickly it has evolved.
Yeah.
So even last summer when, you know, we started talking about it, I would say there was a lot of immaturity around all of the discussions between all parties, whether those parties were buyers, sellers, bankers, investors, public market players, pipe investors, venture capitalists, angel investors, founder, like lawyers. Like there were a few people that really understood what to do, but there was an enormous amount of misunderstanding of what was happening, how things worked, what the incentives and motivations were, and how to play it out successfully for a company. And even just a description of what got played out was very obtuse. And I think today there's still huge amounts of lack of understanding, but it's much, much clearer and more normalized across the system. And whenever I get involved in something, you know, there's always the edge case of things fail. Like whenever I fund a company, you always have to accept that the company might fail.
Yeah.
So that's a given in any scenario of what you do. It's sort of like saying as a human being, eventually you're going to die. And so for me, I come at this believing this is going to be a long-term part of the capital structure of entrepreneurship and emerging companies. And it'll be a powerful part of the transition from private to public markets. There's a chance that it's a phase and there are restructuring of other activities that cause it to be something that has its time and then moves on.
I don't see that.
But my general sense and my belief, having now been soaking in it for the last 9 months, is that it's a capital structure.
Awesome. Well, I'm just so glad that a parallel that I'm smart enough to sense that you would be up for something like that. And there's so many bad takes that I just have no time to listen to them because I can call you and you're going to give the honest take.
Well, you know, the other side of this, Howard, you know this from my personality, right? I like to get involved in things that are new in the domain in which I've spent a lot of time. So, you know, the notion of being, if you go back to the Web 2.0 timeframe when that was starting to emerge, and the idea of a super angel, mm-hmm. right, where a super angel made lots of investments and they were successful entrepreneurs who made 20, 30, 40 angel investments, which today we don't even talk about. Mm-hmm. But in 2005, 6, 7 was a new thing. Well, between 1994 and 1996, I made 40 angel investments with the money that I made from my first company.
Personal ones. Yeah, I was one of them. So
yeah, as an angel investor, right? So I could go through a series of things like that, which would include, by the way, TechStarts, which was, you know, the second accelerator program that was created. It's one of the couple of global, very visible, significant ones that have had long runs and lots of impact. And it was a fascinating idea that was very unformed at the very beginning. And when we started TechStars in 2006, people said, why are you doing that? That's stupid. Like, oh, it might be stupid, but could be really cool. I remember when AngelList announced syndicates, we were the next day we announced a syndicate on AngelList at Founder Group. And we did about 65 investments from our syndicate. And we learned a ton about both the strengths and weaknesses of that approach.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Correct. You did that. I wanted to, but didn't. I'm glad I missed it, but I get it. Yeah.
I could give another five examples like that, but it's something. I mean, my partners and I are one of the, if not the first VC firm that made as part of its institutional motion, investing in other funds. There are plenty of fund of funds that invest in venture funds, but also do direct investments. I think we were the first VC firm that institutionalized majority of our capital goes into direct investing, but 25% of our capital is invested in pre-seed and seed stage funds. And that's part of our network and our business. So I like to be involved in these new things and learn from them and be part of shaping them.
Yeah, I feel it's the biggest thing to happen. There'll be a lot of bad behavior, but there's always bad behavior. I think it's the most innovative because it's an old idea. It was an extraction product. It'll still be used for extraction on the bad side, but it'll lead also to exploring and opportunity on their side. I feel like it just feels very decentralized. Obviously, it's impossible for something that you rely on capital from the centralized system for now to be decentralized, but it's a move towards some decentralization where investors can be the GM again and not just be on the outside wondering what Vanguard and BlackRock are doing. So kudos to you for doing
it. There's that sneaky decentralized word again.
I know. Probably used improperly, but it's our show. No one gets edit changes except Howie. So this was fun. I learned a lot. I think what's cool in our household is there's now two generations of Lindzens reading your blog. And if Rachel ever meets a guy post-COVID, there could be a third generation Lindzen. Which is, you're influencing potentially three generations of Lindzen. Max,
Rachel,
never going to happen, dude.
Your dad's not putting any pressure on you.
He goes, the Guitar Center guy? Max is still stuck on the Guitar Center. He gives you no cred. So, but you got one Lindzen on your side. Well, you got two on your side, Alan and Rachel and then myself. But even Max, he says hello today when I said I was talking to you.
Hi, Max.
So, all right, say hi to Amy. As usual, and we'll compare de-SPAC notes hopefully one day soon on the other side. And I appreciate everything you've shared with me over the years as a mentor, so I appreciate it, buddy.
Always fun to spend an hour bullshitting with you on with Knut in the background. Knut, enjoy Norway.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Knut's awake. He enjoyed it. Thanks, buddy. Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Your legend.
He is a legend.
We toned it down. You see, I wanted to
He's
just go
so
slower.
He's so wise.
Yeah. The way he wrapped it up is, right, like the guy's been, he's in the mix. You know, you can be in the mix from Aspen. You can, that's, I forgot to talk about the emerging markets of America. The old flyover states next are episode. Now the emerging market. No, well, this is what he'd been writing about for years. You know, if you have 100,000 people like Boulder did, you can be a hub. So COVID just made his 2012 book more relevant than ever. So go pick that up. I'll put it in the post to go with this. You are listening to Panic with Friends. That is a, I think our first four-timer or three-timer, Brad Feld. Can't believe it's been over a year. We're at a year.
Yes, we are.
Been a long year, man.
I don't know. It's been long and it's been fast. I don't know. It's
No, it's been long. I've been staring at you for a year. It feels like a long year. So you're taking a break, slacker. No, you're off to Norway.
I'll still be producing these, editing these, and posting them. So we'll be good.
All right. So safe travels to Norway. This is Panic with Friends. We sit down with, obviously, friends. Makes it better. We started out panicking in March of last year, and today we're frolicking in the joy of the reopening and all the new trends that have started. But panic will always be there in the background. And so we'll stick with the name. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, Google to search Panic with Friends, or search my name, Howard Lindzen. Subscribe. You won't have to do anything ever again except get an alert once a week from us that we've got a new show up with an investor, entrepreneur, founder, venture capitalist, trying to stay just a little bit ahead of everybody else. You don't have to be too far ahead of people to make fortunes. Have a great week. Talk to you soon.